are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 9th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, physician Adam Gaffney, writing in the Jacobin, among other places, on single payer being next. Meanwhile, fire and fury. Donald Trump wants to wrap this whole thing up very soon, as he threatens North Korea, and North Korea threatens Guam. Meanwhile, the feds raided Paul Manafort's home right after he testified in front of the Senate and right before Robert Mueller set up a new grand jury. But if we die in a new Holocaust, it will not matter. Also on the program, Trump blows it on opioids. But if we die in a nuclear Holocaust, it may not matter. Meanwhile, Dems' surprising win in Iowa special election. And, of course, if we die in a nuclear Holocaust, well, maybe Iowa, actually, Iowa may be the new capital.
Guess where everything will be fine? In my New Zealand bunker with children's blood, Luther.
Trump administration increases deportation orders and arrests, but can't seem to execute them. Meanwhile, Gorka and Miller explained the president gets a twice-a-day feel-good document.
Would you like one of those, Sammy?
I would like it twice a day. The it's once a day is okay.
Feel-good document. Hello?
All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. You know, contemplated bumping our guest this morning. Well, first off, I should say happy birthday, Myla. She's watching. She's in trouble at the moment, and she usually is not in the habit of downloading the podcast. But, I mean, theoretically, she's at camp right now. So, it is my daughter's 12th birthday. So, longtime listeners, you are old, so am I.
Happy birthday.
So there you go. Contemplated bumping our guest today to discuss the president's words yesterday following a report that the North Koreans have developed a nuke small enough to fit in a missile. And President Trump had this to say, which is a little bit not measured, as it were. But this is him at his golf course, which I think if we're all going to go up in a nuclear fury, you know, it should probably start at a golf course, right? I mean, that seems apropos. Here is Donald Trump responding to the Defense Intelligence Agency's or the report of the Defense Intelligence Agency's analysis that North Korea is now making missile-ready nuclear weapons. Let me just, well, go ahead. Play this clip.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Jesus.
And he went on, I think, a little bit. He sort of reiterated it after that. But a couple of points to make out here. One is that there is not broad agreement or consensus amongst U.S. intelligence community that it is the case that North Korea has produced nuclear weapons for ballistic missile delivery to include delivery by ICBM class missiles. So this is from the Defense Intelligence Agency and from another intelligence community analysis. So, you know, skepticism is always warranted, even if you have 17 different agencies signing off on any given report. Nevertheless, the president had that to say, and there's not much more to add to this story. Following that, Kim Jong-un government said that they would attack Guam. And I think they said September 9th. I'm not quite sure. I've seen that reported in some places and not in others. We will talk more about this, and because there are certainly some in the neoconservative caucus who are really don't have a lot of issues, it seems to me, with bombing North Korea, or basically, it appears to instigate some type of conflict there, basically
Lindsey
because,
Graham.
Well, yes, and we'll talk about this later in the program, but it's not just Lindsey Graham. And that they are willing to instigate this conflict because there's a sense that might as well do it now while it's contained. And we have tape of Donald Trump saying this very, espousing this very theory from 10 years ago or so. And we will be playing that later in the program. So We will get to all this, but there's not a whole lot to discuss here. And frankly, you know, it's unclear how this is being received by the North Koreans, or at least in that region, whether or not there's a genuine concern. But we will talk more about that later in the program. And before we get to Adam Gaffney and talk about, you know, one of the things we wanted to talk about, obviously, is last week we had Josh Holland on, and he made an argument that, I guess, ultimately Medicare for All should not be a litmus test for Democratic candidates because it is not necessarily the best or possibly or even an achievable policy. And therefore, you're setting up unreasonable expectations. We'll talk to Adam Gaffney for another opinion on that. But first, I got to tell you, maybe you know this, a single router Wi-Fi model won't work for our increasingly high bandwidth world. What you need is a distributed system, Eero. I set this up in my house. Look, here's the dilemma that we have in my apartment. Not huge. It's a good size, but it's not. A little bit bigger in this office. Probably like I'm not quite twice size.
It's,
but
it's a bit bigger.
We got 10,000, almost 1050 square feet. This is 660.
Yeah, right.
It's just that it's set up long.
Right.
And we've got these walls. I don't know if this makes a difference. That are like, they're like old. It's a 1930s building. So it's like horsehair and cement in there. Oh, yeah. No, it's crazy. So we don't have Wi-Fi reception in Myla and Saul's room or in our bedroom. It goes in and out. Or the bathroom. I wasn't going to bring that up, but we would lose it in the bathroom. And it doesn't matter what Wi-Fi router. I've gotten the most powerful Wi-Fi router. It still can't work. I pick up my neighbor's, but I don't pick up mine. I set up the Eero system. It blankets your home because it has multiple satellite versions of it. And the second generation has 5G. So it's now tri-band and twice as fast as the original Eero. So you can go, you can do it all in your room. Not only does, and apparently can also connect to like low power devices, such as like locks and doorbells, other sensors, if you want to make a smart home. But it also, what I like, it has, I can, with an app, first of all, it was super easy to set up. Super easy. And my recommendation is if you're going to replace your Wi-Fi router, just take a screen grab of how you've read out your existing network. And then you fill it in exactly. You don't have to change like your printer and your stuff like that. So it took me about 10 minutes to replace the existing router. Set up all three. You use an app. I can now, via the app, turn off the night lights and the LED buttons on the satellite units. I can also shut off Myla's computer and phone and schedule it.
Oh, so I don't I'm need sorry. A separate, I'm so. Oh, what was that? It's off.
I don't
control.
Need. I don't need a separate unit at 10 p.m. Shut down. She gets no Wi-Fi. And it
just
turns
clapped
back
your
on
hands
at 7
like one of those old commercials.
I was so
with,
excited
like, the
about
clap
it.
Lights or whatever that would come on at 2 a.m.
And it gives you custom support, and you can actually upgrade to a pro level where you can cut off certain websites. I don't do that. We let Myla go wherever she wants on the web.
Sounds like a good idea.
Folks, you can get free overnight shipping. Visit Eero, Eero.com. Select overnight as the shipping option and enter majority at checkout. That's Eero, Eero.com. Offer code majority at checkout. I love this Wi-Fi thing. It's great. And it also, on the app, it tells you what your upload and download speeds are. I don't think most people care. I do. All right, I got to take a quick break. And when we come back, Adam Gaffney. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report, on the phone. Adam Gaffney, an instructor at Harvard Medical School, also on the board of Physicians for a National Healthcare Plan, and who writes in the Jacobin, among other outlets. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
All right. So last week we had Josh Holland on, who was arguing that Medicare for All as a litmus test is problematic for I guess the maybe perhaps political reasons, but I think more because his argument was that Medicare for All is not a panacea and not necessarily possible. And so I wanted to start with you know, with what would ultimately be, you know, I guess the alternatives. And one piece that you wrote in the Jacobin is the case against the public option. Tell us, I mean, what, as we look at alternatives to something like Medicare for All, which would be a single payer system, what is problematic with the other options?
Well, I think we need to begin by identifying the primary problems with the U.S. healthcare system in order to even be able to assess whether these other solutions would solve those issues. So some of the biggest issues include uninsurance. 28 million people under Obamacare remain uninsured. Underinsurance, rising numbers of workers with high deductibles, co-payments, co-insurance, things that squeeze their wallet every time they actually access healthcare, rising drug costs. I mean, just to give one figure, the Kaiser Family Foundation employer benefits survey found that deductibles for workers have risen by 300% over the last decade. So uninsurance and underinsurance remain primary problems in the U.S. healthcare system. And the reason why I disagree with Josh Holland's argument, and the reason why I very firmly continue to believe that Medicare for All is the answer, is that it is the only policy proposal that would actually truly eliminate both uninsurance and underinsurance. The public option would not do that.
And all right, so I mean, let's walk us through why the public option won't. I mean, because I, you know, we heard a lot about it during the Obamacare fight, and it was initially a large part of both Clinton and Obama and Edwards' proposal back in 2008, I guess it was. It ultimately died in the Senate in the hands of not just Joe Lieberman, but I think it was Conrad and Blanche Lincoln and maybe Baucus and Ben Nelson. At least those four or five were responsible for knocking it out of the box, as far as I can recall. But give us a sense of what it was meant to do and why it doesn't deal with the issues of either one of those, the uninsured or the underinsured.
Well, let's identify what people mean when they talk about a public option right now. The current iteration of the public option that people are speaking about is a public insurance plan that is sold on the Obamacare marketplaces, okay, that would compete against other private health insurance plans. And the idea being that it would keep the private insurers honest, that it would provide another option, that it would provide lower premiums. You know, I would point out that the Congressional Budget Office has actually scored the public option back in 2013, that version of the public option. They found that it would not have any significant effect on overall number of uninsured. They found that it would reduce premiums somewhat because it was paying providers at a lower rate, but otherwise it would not lower uninsurance. Because don't forget, people who buy their insurance plans through the marketplaces are a relatively small minority of the country. And the public option, because it's an option, would not apply to all the people who are uninsured. So there's no evidence to suggest that the current versions of the public option would reduce that 28 million number of uninsured at all, much less to zero. Medicare for All would reduce it to zero.
So when we talk about those 28 million, who are they? I mean, what percentage of those people are in Republican-controlled states that do not expand Medicaid? And then who are the rest?
Great question. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I can tell you it is a mix. A minority of them are people who are not getting Medicaid, even though they should be, because they are in Republican-controlled states, as you say. And expanding Medicaid to all 50 states should remain an important objective of the left and the progressives, and I'm completely on board with that. Some of them are undocumented immigrants. Some of them are people who simply do not feel that the Obamacare plans available to them are affordable. So it's a mix of people. Overall, they're more likely to be low income. Overall, they're more likely to be Black and Hispanic than they are white.
Okay. And so let's talk about, I mean, how we would let's go through the different options, I guess. I mean, where we are now. I mean, presuming for the time being, and I think that this is, I'm not 100% frankly confident that that Trump care is really truly dead. To be honest with you, I mean,
I hope so. I hope you're wrong, but we'll see.
I hope so too. I mean, but you know, there's a lot of things that can happen between now and 2018, and not the least of which is, you know, Robert Menendez, who's going on trial in a month and a half, and you know. That seat will go to a Republican if he vacates it before 2018. And
that's a fair point.
And there's your 51st vote. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's just one scenario. For the sake of this conversation, let's assume that Trump care is done. What are the various options that you hear are being floated about?
On the left, I think there's really two main paths. One is Medicare for All, which is achieving unprecedented amount of support within the Democratic Party. A majority of House Democrats have signed on to the bill that's currently there. And the other side, I think, is what Paul Krugman advocated earlier this week in the New York Times, which is to keep the ACA as it is, bolster it somewhat, add a public option. Those are the two real things you're talking about. Josh Holland sort of talks about a more robust sort of version of a public option than does Krugman. But those are the two main approaches, a sort of incremental building on the ACA versus a more fundamental reform in the creation of a national health insurance program like many other nations.
And so walk us through, like, how would this take place? I mean, I guess the concern that Josh Holland expressed in the piece was sort of a combination of policy and political, in that there would be an overpromising and an inability to actually get there. But give us a sense of how you perceive it happening.
Well, I mean, I think it's important just to point out one thing about Josh Holland's piece. I mean, one of the things he says is that, you know, giving people Medicare in place of their current plans is going to make people unhappy. He writes that, you know, all these people who are currently insured through their employers may not be so keen on being switched into Medicare when Medicare may have actually less benefits. And that would be a real problem if it were true. But we're not talking about Medicare for All. We're talking about, to use the title of John Conyers' bill, expanded and improved Medicare for All. We're talking about Medicare without the co-payments, without the deductibles, and with wider cost sharing. So I think one of the big arguments here of loss aversion that he makes is really not grounded on a good evidence. I mean, he's aware of John Conyers' bill and what it would do, but he doesn't really incorporate that into his analysis. In terms of how this would sort of be implemented, I think is your question, or how we would go about actually creating Medicare for All. I mean, I think you can look at the passage of Medicare itself as sort of a historical example. You know, we can talk about what the best transitional approach is, and that's a debate that we can that's worth having. But that's a separate debate from what our end goal should be, and whether we should pass legislation creating a new public universal health system. And I think that debate has mostly been won by progressives already.
All right. So let's talk about, I mean, the transitional thing. I mean, because I agree with you that that Josh Holland was looking at a sort of Medicare as it is today, as opposed to how it's envisioned, certainly in the Conyers bill. And I think by most people, I mean, there's a, you know, when people, it seems to me, when people advocate for a single payer system, what they're really advocating for is a situation where they're not going to have to really exert any resources, much resources, or really much in resources in terms of dollars and in terms of like sweat equity, if you will, in getting the things that people feel they need to maintain good health. So, like, you know, when I go to the eye doctor, when I go to the dentist, I'm gonna get covered. Well, so talk about the interim steps for a moment that you perceive that would get us there. But I'm also curious, as a doctor yourself, what's going to happen with your colleagues who are necessarily going to have to, I mean, isn't the reality of this that it's going to involve doctors making less ultimately?
I think if you look at the experience of the implementation of Canadian Medicare, that doctors didn't actually lose out when they implemented their Canadian system, their Medicare system in Canada. And I think that if you look at the pay that physicians get in Canada, that it's actually quite reasonable, and that doctors, you know, comparable to what doctors make in the United States.
Is that true? Is the average doctor's salary, I mean, what doctors take in Canada, really comparable to what it is in the United States?
I will send you the – I cannot say it's exactly comparable, but you were talking about physicians making, you know, six-figure salaries in Canada, similar medians as to what we're talking about here. And obviously there are differences between the two countries in overall income and other factors that make direct one-to-one comparisons different. But the overall point is that doctors do quite reasonably well in Canada, and I think they could do fine under a single-payer system as well. I don't think that we need really to talk about slashing healthcare workers' salaries in order to do it to a single-payer system. We obviously want to have all healthcare workers on board with such a transition. You can't have a complete, you know, you can't take on all healthcare workers and have them sort of march away from this if you're going to implement it. So what we're trying to do in Physicians for National Health program is to really work on the physician side, to get everybody on board so that we can make this happen, because we clearly need healthcare workers to be part of this struggle and to be part of the transition to this program.
Well, all right, so where do the cost savings come from? I mean, like, I'm aware, right, that Medicare, the administrative costs are significantly less than insurance. But really, it seems to me that, and I think, you know, the data bears this out, that the problem with healthcare in this country in terms of cost is not simply the cost of insurance, but it's the cost of delivering medicine. I mean, there's, you know, I reference this all the time, but it's that, you know, sort of famous Atul Gawande piece about those two cities in Texas where Medicare reimbursement rates differ by 30% because of the fact in one place doctors owned, you know, medical devices that ended up getting used a lot. Who's going to lose out in this system? Aside from obviously insurance companies, although theoretically, right, many of these companies just end up being, instead of the insurers, maybe just sort of the administrators. Who's going to lose out here?
So there's a lot of questions wrapped in there. So first off, why is American healthcare more expensive? A wide variety of reasons. But let me tell you one that it's not. It's not that we use more healthcare than other countries. Yes, there are certain types of healthcare we may use more than other countries, say MRI scans. But overall, we are not going to the doctor more frequently on average than people in other high-income nations. We're not being hospitalized more than people in other high-income nations. So it's not actually the quantity of it's not the quantity of healthcare that American individuals use in America that's driving our higher healthcare prices. We have higher healthcare prices, and that factors into that has a number of different factors that are behind it. But let me make a quick point of clarification. We are not saying that with a single-payer system, we're going to suddenly reduce U.S. healthcare spending to that of Great Britain or Canada. We're not going to do that. What we are saying is a little more modest. We're saying that with the hundreds of billions of dollars that you could save a year through reduced administrative costs because of getting rid of the private health insurance industry and through reduced drug costs, that would be enough money to cover the uninsured and to expand coverage for everybody else. It's a more modest claim than we're suddenly going to reduce U.S. healthcare spending to that of Great Britain. That's not happening.
So, all right. So the idea is that it's not necessarily about reducing the cost per capita, but rather redistributing and the way that we expend that money.
Exactly. We can save – one estimate puts the savings from transition to a single-payer system through administrative costs at over $500 billion a year. The savings from reducing drug prices by about 50% would get you an approximate more than $120 billion a year. That combined, you know, in excess of $600 billion a year would be enough to eliminate uninsurance and enough to eliminate underinsurance. So at the end of the day, even if we're spending the same amount per capita, we are covering everybody for everything. And we are funding it by your means, by how much you can afford to put into the system. So that would be a much more equitable system with truly universal access. And that's something that that the public option or any of these other incremental approaches doesn't come close to achieving.
So what do you anticipate? I mean, the raise, what we're going to have to raise in taxes. And I think, you know, everybody listening to this, I think, has probably had it hopefully drilled into their head that what you pay in taxes, you're going to save in healthcare costs plus, right? I mean, that's the key to this whole thing. I may pay an extra $5 in taxes, but I'm going to save $7 in healthcare costs over the course of my lifetime. But what do we know what those numbers are?
Well, I can't give you a tax plan for this because it differs by the bill. You know, Senator Sanders is coming out with a bill, I believe, quite soon that's going to probably have its own tax proposal. Conyers' bill has its own tax proposal. So I can't give you your payroll tax will increase by this right now. What I can say is that, yes, the point you made is exactly right, that for the majority of people, we can expect that their new taxes will be lower than their previous healthcare expenditures. Remember, that previous healthcare expenditure includes both premiums, copayments, deductibles, as well as income that you're not getting because your employer is spending the money on healthcare instead. But we're going, you know, the funding issue is obviously critical, but there's no agreed upon tax sort of proposal that everybody's on board with yet at this point.
And so how do you, I mean, what is the sales pitch to the people who, I mean, the reality is there's still, you know, a significant portion of people in this country who, and you know, it belies a certain measure of rationality, right? And even an awareness, like you started to say that when we talk about the public option, the reason why its impact would be so minimal in terms of it actually touching people's lives, as opposed to, and there's this, another argument that it theoretically opens the door towards, you know, this path for Medicare for all or a single payer, is that we're talking about a small amount of people, right? I mean, the individual market in and of itself is still a fraction of the people who get healthcare in this country. Never mind then the fraction of that fraction that would be on the public option. What is the key in terms of selling the different constituencies, right? Let's for the moment assume that the insurance companies, it's just going to be like, well, a lot of your, you know, you're talking to the employers of the employees of the insurance companies is like, well, there'll probably be opportunities for you because you have a skill set that we could be using in a Medicare for all type of situation. Right. But beyond that, what is the pitch to the different constituencies?
This is the pitch. And this is the beauty of single payer as both policy, but as a political project. There is something for everybody, almost everybody in Medicare for all. Okay. So what is the pitch for someone who was already insured, who gets their insurance through their employer or who gets their insurance through Obamacare? The pitch is this.
Or their union, I guess, for that matter.
The union, it's a union plan, right. The pitch is this. You no longer have copayments. You no longer have deductibles. You will not lose your insurance if you lose your job. You will not lose your insurance if your spouse divorces you and you're insured through him or her, okay? You never need to worry about medical bills again. That's a pretty good pitch. What's the pitch if you're on Medicare? The pitch if you're already on Medicare is, hey, you buy this supplementary plan for Medicare because Medicare doesn't cover all your medical expenses. It doesn't cover your copayments. You don't need to buy that plan anymore. You don't need to worry about forking over the dollars, this you know, the relatively few dollars you have for that Medigap plan. Oh, Medicare doesn't currently cover your dental expenses. Well, you know, oral health is a major issue among senior Americans. Our program will do that. What's the pitch for people on Medicaid? Well, the pitch for people on Medicaid is, yes, you have good comprehensive benefits, but you can't take that Medicaid insurance to a lot of doctors and a lot of hospitals. Wouldn't it be nice if you could have equitable access with everybody else and go to the same doctors and hospitals? And moreover, wouldn't it be nice if on Medicaid you could get a raise and not worry about that taking away your insurance? And certainly the pitch for people who don't have insurance is pretty much clear cut, and I barely need to make that. So this is the beauty of Medicare for All as both a policy proposal and as a political project. There's something in it for everybody. And you know what? That's really important because this is not going to be an easy thing to achieve. There's going to be a lot of resistance to this, both from the pharmaceutical company, from the insurance companies. So we need a big coalition to make this happen. And the way I describe it, because of what it does for each separate constituent group, we can actually achieve that coalition. And that's what makes it something that's winnable.
What do you say to the doctors? I mean, presumably, right? I mean, their doctors won't even take insurance at this point. There are doctors who won't take Medicare. Obviously, many won't take Medicaid. What do you say to the doctors in a broad-based way? And what do you say to the major corporations that have created these sort of mini healthcare monopolies in the consolidation that's happened with hospitals across the country?
Well, doctors are fed up with a lot of this stuff. I would say to doctors, don't you want to just focus on taking care of patients and not dealing with innumerable different private health insurance companies who are trying to block X, Y, and Z because it affects their bottom line? Wouldn't you prefer just to focus on what you were trained to do and not being a small businessman or businesswoman, having to deal with all of this complete and utter nonsense in terms of administrative requirements, in terms of paperwork? I mean, doctors are spending more time on paperwork now than they are on anything else, it seems like. To the hospitals, I think many hospitals would be relieved to not have to worry about chasing down patients for deductible payments, for chasing down people who come up and show up uninsured, to being paid less by one insurer versus the other. Hospitals spend an enormous amount of their overall revenue on administration. They could cut down on that. To health insurance executives, I would say, find a new job is what I'd say to them. And then to big corporations that are not healthcare corporations, I would say, well, wouldn't it be nice to, just not worry about healthcare costs, pay into a payroll tax or whatever it is, and not have to worry year after year after year about paying rising healthcare costs and be able to compete on a more of a level playing ground with other companies in other countries? That would be my pitch for those individual sectors.
All right. So from a political standpoint, the idea of a litmus test for Medicare for All on, let's say, Democratic politicians. I mean, where are you on that? And one of the things that it seems to me that the Affordable Care Act, and, I think it was a mixed bag in terms of what it provided. I think it was definitely a positive step. And one of the things that's clear is that if it is the case that, and maybe even if it's not the case that the Trump care is dead, one way or another, it has been an effective step, right? Maybe this is sort of circular in a way, but the idea with the public option, right, was that it was going to be a gateway to more comprehensive coverage outside of the exchanges. It was going to introduce the notion of a Medicare-type program for people who are under 65. And even though that never happened, the Affordable Care Act itself has created expectations and an appreciation about how insurance was prior to the Affordable Care Act that seems to have pushed the ball forward, right? I mean, people didn't realize the idea of that people will not give up the patient protection aspects of Obamacare. The things like, pre-existing conditions, no rescission, no lifetime or annual caps, essential health benefits. The idea that those things are now sacrosanct, whereas, 7-8 years ago, I don't even think most people realized half those things were problems because they'd never got to that point with their health insurance, or they didn't think they would.
Well, listen, I think we are in agreement that the Affordable Care Act helped a lot of people. I mean, the pre-existing conditions provisions are extremely popular and are common sense. Obamacare expanded health coverage to 20 million people who would otherwise be uninsured by, you know, standard estimates. We're not going back and litigating the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act helped people. It has certainly had a beneficial effect in terms of coverage and access. But what we're talking about is what is the right way to move forward. Now, I would agree with you. There has been what I can perceive as a shift in the discourse towards a notion of a right to health care.
Yes.
The fact that Trump Care sunk so low, the fact that it was so despised, the fact that it was one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation imaginable, despite the fact that Obamacare wasn't that popular, speaks to this really degree of social cohesion around the notion of healthcare as a right. And I think it only gained steam as a result of the resistance against Trump Care, because the Trump Care Act, the anti-Trump Care resistance, made arguments in terms of a moral framework, in terms of life and death, in terms of a right to health. I think that that kind of ideology, that kind of ethos and morality is what is going to take this battle forward. Once you accept the premise that people shouldn't be punished for their illnesses, for their chronic illnesses, because their pre-existing conditions, then through higher premiums, then why should we charge them higher deductibles? It's because right. They have more healthcare needs, right? And if we say that the Republicans are going to make 50 million people uninsured, why is it acceptable to have 28 million uninsured? The logic against Trump Care is the same logic that is going to help us achieve Medicare for all. It is the ethos of healthcare universalism, and I don't think you can put this back in its box.
No, I agree. And I think, I guess what I'm saying is a little bit more. I'm making a slightly less ambitious argument, which is that that in some respects, and maybe, like I say, this could be circular, but Obamacare, in some way, made the argument for incrementalism, insofar as, look, it was what you could get at the time, the most you could get at the time. But what it did is it had that impact where it made people aware that really healthcare should be a right, right? Which includes all those premises that you made about why should, what there's no, if it's a right, there's no logic to having, having it to be just out of reach from a deductible standpoint or a copay standpoint, or just out of reach insofar as it being a universal. And I guess what I'm saying is, does, the idea of, let's say, a Medicare buy-in for everybody, or, I think what Holland suggested was automatic enrollment in a Medicare system at birth that you can only lose if it is supplanted with employer-based healthcare or something to that effect. I mean, I guess that's what I'm getting at is, is that litmus test. It should, in your opinion, how hard and fast should that litmus test be? How much of the argument for Medicare for all should be seen as sort of a journey or a process, or should it be this is something that has to happen? This has to be the next step.
I think for too long we've been going down the incremental road. I think this is the next step. I mean, what are we going to wait for? We're going to do some incremental move and then 20 years later be back, I'll be back on your show talking about this again. I mean, the debate over healthcare reform in the United States has been going on for more than 100 years. We've tried Obamacare. It was an incremental step. It did not take us to universal healthcare. It attenuated some of the injustices of the U.S. healthcare system. The next natural step is for national health insurance, something that people was in the centerpiece of the Democratic platform back in the 1970s. This is a sort of rightward regression that we're having now if we're going to talk about abandoning a national health insurance program. Now, these sort of more aggressive forms of incrementalism that you're talking about, you're born into Medicare, for instance, but you lose it if you get a job, get employer-sponsored coverage. I mean, you can talk about these arguments, but the reality is that something like that is going to decimate the private health insurance industry. They're going to should fight it tooth and nail as strong as they're going to fight single payer. And it wouldn't have many of the same benefits in terms of the administrative savings, in terms of the system-wide drug savings. So why should we fight to get into this, you know, death struggle with the private health insurance industry over a incremental sort of step right. that's not even going to take us to where we want to be? If we're going to do that, if we're going to go all the way, then we might as well go all the way with what we want and what's the optimal solution. Now, if you take something like a very narrowly defined public option that's just available to people buying insurance on the exchanges, yeah, I mean, you might be able to achieve that, but it's going to affect so few people's lives. It's not going to really develop – allow you to accumulate the political capital necessary to actually do much more.
Right. And you, in that proposal, in other words, if you're going to have a proposal that's going to have the full force of opposition, you might as well offer the most obvious and beneficial and politically communicatable proposition that there is. Why convolute things if you're still going to have the same level of resistance to it?
I agree. I mean, imagine trying to explain the Medicare thing, buy-in thing to people. They're not going to get it. You know, you get it and you lose it if you get a job. And then what if you just say, no, we're going to create something like Medicare, a birthright to the U.S. healthcare system. Everybody's enrolled, no co-payments, no deductibles. You can't, you don't, you know, lose it until you're dead. That's something you can actually communicate. These rather convoluted sorts of systems. I mean, part of the problem is they don't generate the kinds of efficiencies that we need. But even putting that aside, they're not, as to use your words, politically communicatable, right? Like, how are you going to actually get that out there? This is going to be a huge fight, and we need a simple, clear, very obvious, and very effective message to actually get this across. And Medicare for All means something to people. And I think that it's because of that, it's a winnable battle.
Adam Gaffney, we will link to your pieces in the Jacobin, making very similar arguments. I appreciate your coming on today and taking the time.
I really enjoyed the discussion. Thank you for having me.
All right, folks. I should also add, you know, this is it could be moot, you know, depending on what happens this week. With
isn't that like an 80s SNL with Jesse Jackson?
Was it?
The question is moot, and he's like a game show host something,
yes,
and it's all like these dumb like Jeopardy questions, and he just like, the question is moot, poverty continues to rise,
right.
The question is moot, we're on the verge of a global nuclear confrontation, and then he wins the show himself because all the questions are moot. It's great.
I've got a solution. Nuke for all.
Nuke
That's
for
the
all.
Way. That's it. No. I actually did see some piece that said a nuclear winter would severely impact
climate change
for the past.
I'm taking fighting extreme weather events very
we
seriously.
We should nuke the sun. It's getting a bit extreme.
I think the sun has been not responsive, frankly, to many requests.
I actually think the the most compelling argument for why you support a Medicare for all is going back to that. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say like, look, you're just not going to be able to attain it, but it's very hard. It seems to me to say, we're going to be able to attain, you're born into Medicare until you lose it with your job, with your employer based health insurance. I actually think that would be an improvement over where we are now. But the point is, from a political standpoint, you're not getting anything. Like, you're not, like, it's not like there's a, you know, it is true that insurance companies, look, the reason why they like those big group insurance plans are, it's not their money. Like, they're not risking any money. They're just doing the administrative work. But it's not like you're short-circuiting any major oppositional constituency by suggesting that plan and by, you know, which I don't think is necessarily in and of itself a bad plan. But the fact is, at one point, you're going to either have to do something that is meaningful enough that you're going to have a tremendous amount of powerful opposition that you have to overcome. Or not. And it's not like, to me, I do think it is the case that incrementalism as a strategy was the case for it was strengthened insofar as that as a culture, we have a different appreciation for what health insurance should be and what access to healthcare should be because of Obamacare. But I would also argue that it's unclear to me that Obamacare and the incrementalism that it represents has undermined the power of those constituencies who would stop us from getting a more comprehensive healthcare system in this country, if that makes sense, right? Because the incrementalism should do two things. It should change the culture so that we have a greater appreciation for what it is that we want and what we expect from our government. And two, it should slowly undermine those forces that are the obstacles to getting that. And it's unclear to me that Obamacare has achieved anything in that sense. But we will obviously be having this conversation for probably at least the next 10 years. I mean, it's possible this will come to a head in 5 years if everything goes really well and we're not, maybe when we lose the coasts of both countries, both of our coasts in this country, it might be an easier thing to do, smaller group of people to insure. I don't think we're going to lose the coast. But part of that is because I think there's also maybe some people in the Senate who are really interested in making sure that the war is fought exclusively in the Pacific. And we will get to those people who are promoting such an idea after we take a break as we head into the fun half. My understanding is we have a fun half, a special fun half ditty. Folks, just a reminder. Oh, I should tell you also, last night was the premiere of the Michael Brooks Show, otherwise known as Trademark BS. You can catch it out on YouTube, or it is now on iTunes. Yes,
Waiting on validation for iTunes.
Okay, so
and the first
the bullshit has not been fully validated, but certainly you can go to our YouTube channel and see it. And
the first post game members premium content is up on Patreon. For
the public show audio will also be up on Patreon,
so. And the public show audio will be on Patreon as well as so iTunes for our first 474 members. Thank
so
you.
There you have it. Nearly 500 people supporting that program. And if you want to support this program, you can head over to jointhemajorityreport.com and become a member of this program. Keep us doing 5 days a week of interviews like the one we did today, or interviews like the one we'll do tomorrow, or occasionally a news recap like we did yesterday. It's your support that keeps this program going. We rely on our members for 92%, right? Was that the latest in the number crunching? If you could see Kelly's face right now. We're still figuring out how to work spreadsheets.
I mean,
you can do that on Google,
say something
right?
Like 99.7. So if we're at 92, something's really...
Need a pivot changing. Table. Need what? A pivot table in Excel.
We need a... We got well. We're having a lot of luck with the magnets that we're selling. So, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, folks. I'm always amazed when I meet people and they don't get their coffee from justcoffee.coop when they listen to this program. Honestly, because they've got great coffee. They've got multiple types of coffee. The shipping is free with the 10% discount. With the coupon code majority, it is more than reasonable. If you're the type of person who buys whole bean, they also will grind it for you beforehand. But if you buy, like, you know, quality coffee, it's a great place for it. And it's all fair trade. So everybody down the line gets paid appropriately. And it's a co-op. So you go to justcoffee.coop. Also, if you buy your craft from Amazon or Jet.com, head over to majoritireportkickback.com. Quick break, 646-257-3920. You can IM the show, and here is that little ditty. Who did it?
DJ Danarchy.
DJ Danarchy, and maybe we'll use this to go into the fun half today. Fun.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
Alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.